go ahead and call to order our committee. This is the Senate Commerce Committee. We have a number of issues on our agenda for today, including a number of work sessions. The chairs, at my discretion, what we're going to do is work through the work sessions first. I'm going to have people coming and going that are members, and so I need to get as many of these bills out as I can. The three bills that we have scheduled for public hearings, and I say public hearings, even though it may say on the form that it was public hearings and possible work sessions, 2891, 2892, and 2893 will only be public hearings today. So, and those are going to be done after we get through the work sessions, as many as we can. As you can see, we're working with the minimum number of members I can work with, and so we may be, depending on where people are at, going to vote immediately on these. But why don't we go ahead and get started, and we're going to start with a work session on House Bill 2202.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2202 is the check cashing bill. It requires check cashing businesses to obtain a license from DCBS. The committee heard this bill on March 21st. There is a -A6 amendment. The A6 amendment adds $5 or 10% of the face value. It doesn't add that part. It adds $5 or to the 10% of the face value of the payment instrument or whichever is greater on page 3, lines 39 and 40 of the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair. There is, I might say, a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. We've been told by the President's office that we can rescind that referral if the committee so chooses. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, and so the chair is willing to take a motion. First, it will be on the -6 amendments.
So moved.
And Senator Avakian has moved the -6 amendments in the House Bill 2202A. Any discussion on the -6s? And if not, I'm going to ask if the committee is 2002.
Yeah, got it.
I can give you a chance to get your...
2202,
excuse me.
And, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
If staff could repeat the effect of the amendment versus what we looked at back on the 21st of May, of March.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Senator Gordley. The amendment on page 3 of the bill, line 39 and 40 of page 3 of the bill, it just adds the words $5 or, and then the bill says currently 10% of the face value of the payment instrument, and then it adds the words whichever is greater. So that's page 3 of the bill, lines 39 and 40.
So the purpose or the of the amendment is basically to allow for some type of fee to be charged
for the other payment instrument, so they don't have to do the 10% of the face value only.
Got it.
And we have representatives from DCBS here if you'd like to ask a question of them.
Okay. Senator Monroe, are you okay?
I'm fine.
All right. So no objection on the motion to adopt the ACE or the A6 into or the -6 into 2202A. That would be ordered.
And Mr. Chair, move 2202A as amended to the floor, but they do pass recommendation.
All right, and I'm going to go ahead and ask that you conclude that motion with and request rescission of the subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
And
I heard him say that.
I thought I did, too. So so moved by Senator Avakian that House Bill 2202A, as amended by the -6 amendments, be referred to the floor with a due pass recommendation and a request the rescission of the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Any discussions on the motion?
Just a question for staff. Can you help me recall whether we had testimony in opposition, any testimony in opposition?
We did have some, two people, they signed in not in favor or in opposition. I believe it was Diane McCartney from Ace Cash and Thomas Shockless from CFSA, which I think is...
Okay.
Does that help you recall?
It does.
Okay,
it does.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Any other comments? Any objection? That'll be ordered. And so House Bill 2202A with the dash six amendments is on its way to the floor with the due pass recommendation, also requesting the rescission of the subsequent referral to Ways and Means. And on this one here, the chair will take this one. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2202. And we'll open up a work session on House Bill 2247.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2247 repeals the sunset law and allowing nurse practitioners to provide compensable medical services and workers' compensation claims. We heard this on Monday, May 7th, and this just needed a conflict amendment from Legislative Council's office, and we have received the conflict amendment. It's on your desk today. And it's fairly complicated just because they tend to be, but I could explain it if the committee so chooses. DCBS has had a chance to look at this, and they say it's fine. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Why don't you just give us the framework as to what the conflict amendment is going to be accomplishing as compared to going into great detail?
Basically, there's a conflict with the recently passed bills, House Bill 2756A, the care provider bill that we passed on Monday, and House Bill 2244A, the partial permanent disability bill, sunset bill we passed on Monday. And those sections that conflict have been changed with this conflict amendment. And is that enough?
That's sufficient for me. Is there anyone else that has needs more? Mm-hmm. So what we're looking at is the need for a motion on the dash A2s.
So move.
Senator Avakian moves the dash A2s into the House Bill 2247 at this point. Is there any further discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
And move 2247 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. That's 2247A as amended.
All right. So the motion is to move House Bill 2247A as amended by the dash two amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objection? So ordered and a carrier. Senator Monroe will be gracious to carry this one. Thank you. We'll close the work session on 2247. And we'll open a work session on House Bill 2253.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2253 was the Bureau of Labor and Industries bill that consolidates the BOLI Wage and Hour Commission and State Apprenticeship Council Training Council enforcement laws. It allows BOLI to seek court enforcement of subpoenas prior to filing of a formal complaint. We heard this on May 2nd. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. And regarding the 2253, it's my understanding that it's ready to go without amendments. Is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. We do have a letter from BOLI explaining the question that came up in committee about the ORS chapters and how they do not, in fact, increase the power of BOLI.
And so what we want to do is just put on the record that the letter that we are referring to, I assume, is the May 4th, 2007 letter?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And so for the record, anyone that's wanting to follow the history of this can go there and get that information. So the chair is willing to take a motion to move this bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
I'll move 2253 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Avakian moves House Bill 2253 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Any objection? So ordered. And Senator Avakian, would you be kind enough to carry this one?
Sure.
And we'll close the work session on 2253. We'll open a work session on 2254. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2254 is another BOLI bill. We heard this on May 2nd. It's the one that imposes a 45-day timeline for an employer to provide copies of personnel records. There is no amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. And let's see, so House Bill 2254, the chair is willing to take a motion as to moving it to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair, I would move approval of 2254 and send it to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Monroe moves House Bill 2254 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussions? Any objections? So ordered. And do I have a volunteer to carry 2254? Okay. Senator Gordley will be our carry on this one. Thank you very much. We'll close the work session on 2254. Open a work session on 2255. Ms. Braun?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of committee. We heard this one on May 2nd also. It's another bully bill. It makes discrimination against an employee for filing a wage claim or reporting violations of working conditions, minimum wage, and overtime laws and unlawful employment practice. It clarifies that compensatory damages are an available remedy. There is no amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. Chair is willing to take a motion on House Bill 2255.
Go ahead, Senator.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2255 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Monroe moves House Bill 2255 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any any discussion? Any comments? Any objection? So ordered. And let's see. 2255.
Gordley.
Senator Gordley, would you be kind enough to take this one to the floor, too?
Yes.
Thank you.
Yes, your topic.
So we'll close the work session on 2255. We'll open a work session on 2259.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2259 is another bully bill. We heard this on May 2nd. It increases the time frame in which an employee may file a retaliation complaint under the Occupational Safety and Health Laws from 30 days to 90 days. It declares an emergency effective on passage.
All right, and chair is willing to take a motion on House Bill 2260.
2259.
Oh, excuse me, I've jumped the page. 2259.
Mr. Chair, I have after the motion, I'm sorry. So moved to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Senator Avakian moves House Bill 2259 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Senator Avakian?
I was wondering if there was any further discussion about why it was moved from 30 to 90 days as opposed to a full year statute of limitations like the rest of the employment discrimination statutes.
Mr. Chair, may I respond? When that came up in committee, the testimony was that that was a political judgment. It was a compromise.
That's what I remember based
on. No, I do remember that very clearly, too. I thought a few of us had expressed that maybe that wasn't a good enough reason, and I thought some other people were going to talk about it in the meantime, but I made the motion to send it to the floor. Let's not spend our time now.
Did that happen? Did that conversation take place?
We received an email from Bureau of Labor and Industry explaining that it was a political compromise.
And since this would, if we make amendments, it's going to have to go back to the House. As I kind of go, the wind of the House may not be blowing in the same direction that we as a committee may be contemplating, which would put in the conference committee.
And this is why I'm not suggesting we do something different. However, I was a little concerned that whatever political compromise there was never really inclusive of what the Senate was going to do. And I think very clearly, in my mind at least, I see no rationalization for a 90-day timeline on one type of adverse employment action and a one-year timeline on everything else.
Well, Senator, if you want to withdraw your motion...
Nope, let's get it going.
Well, I mean, we could definitely keep this...
I said for the record, let's keep it going.
We could always have a conference committee. We need to have some conferences here. A little more processing. I think we have a motion before us to send House Bill 2259 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as it currently reads. Is there any other discussion?
Maybe we can have Majority Leader Hunt come carry it for us on the floor.
By special
Mr.
engagement.
Chair, under discussion, I agree with Senator Avakian, but I'm also reading the language of the head of BOLI, and I think he would prefer to have it this way rather than risk a conference committee.
All right. So I think we've had enough discussion. Is there any objection to 2259 going to the floor with a due pass recommendation? And Senator Beyer, you're just walking in, so if you don't know if you want to be brought up to speed before we actually take this vote. This is 2259. This is the one that dealt with changing the time frame for filing the retaliation complaint.
What amendments went into it?
None.
Oh.
It's 30 to 90. So,
you're voting as we speak?
We are. You just happen to walk in the room right at
you
the time.
You
want
to step out so I'm still absent so I don't have to vote?
No, I personally, I'd actually excuse you from the vote just because you're just
that's
walking
fine.
In.
That'd be great.
Okay.
All right, so we're going to go ahead and have a vote that will be for, in favor, and Senator Beyer, because of his timely coming into the room after everything has occurred, it will be excused for that vote. So we're going to, and Senator Monroe, will you carry this one, or do you want me to carry this one? Either
I
way.
I can.
All right, Senator Monroe will be our carrier on 2259. With that, we're going to close the work session on 2259, and we're going to open a work session now on 2260.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2260 is another bully bill. We heard it on May 2nd. It allows compensatory and punitive damages and other relief for unlawful employment practices based on race, religion, color, sex, national origin, marital status, or age. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right. And before us on House Bill 2260, there's no amendments, so the chair is willing to take a motion on the bill as it is presented to us.
Move it to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Senator Avakian moves House Bill 2260 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Senator Gordley and Senator Beyer.
Thank you very much. Again, for the record, I remain deeply disappointed that AOI expressed opposition to this bill, and I am awaiting some formal communication from the leadership of AOI that provides an explanation of why they would oppose this measure. This is the 21st century, and we need our leading institutions, whether they be business, civic, public, private, to stand on the side of equal rights, social justice, affirmative action, equal opportunity. And I, again, am just making this appeal and expressing this disappointment. I'm making this appeal once again to Associated Oregon Industries to communicate why it is they've taken this stance. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Beyer, I think you're next.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will be opposed to the motion. The issue that was not ever even mentioned in this committee in the hearing was the fact that this Senate Bill 2 has passed and now, I guess, is, I think as of today, signed into law, if it wasn't already signed into law, will be is the statute or is part of the statutes. And so we now have an issue of I'm going to call choice of people of their lifestyle or their how they dress or want to be known, and the employers are going to be subject and potentially liable for damage, compensatory and punitive damages for those issues. And I just think that's inappropriate.
All right. Thank you. Any other comments?
Just to round out the record, Mr. Chair, I agree with Senator Beyer's conclusion and would just add good, because I think it's an appropriate conclusion to the statute.
Thank you.
A comment with respect to Representative Beyer, or Senator Beyer, who I think has every right to make the record. I just want to round out the legislative record on the opinions of the committee members.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Unless there's another burning desire to say anything else, we'll go ahead and see what objections we have to this moving forward. Senator Beyer will be registered as objecting. With that, the motion does carry. House Bill 2260 will be going to the Senate floor with the due pass recommendation, and the chair will carry this one, unless Senator Monroe, did you want it?
I thought maybe Senator Gordley might want to carry this one.
You're more than welcome to have it. I was just trying to split up the load. If you want it, it's yours, Senator Gordley.
Mr. Chair, I would like for you to carry the bill. I will speak to it, but I would like for you to carry this bill.
All right, thank you. And we'll close the work session on House Bill 2260. We're going to open the work session on House Bill 2943.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2943 was a bill that we heard on May 2nd, and this one is the one about the Independent Medical Examination Association standards, and the question for the committee, we put in a dash one amendment, which is on your desk, whether we should change the may to the shall for adopting those as the standard for professional conduct for those performing IMEs, independent medical examinations.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the dash two A2 amendments into 2143.
Senator Vaca moves the dash A2 amendments into House Bill 2943. Discussions?
Can you hold a second? I want to see what difference that makes, because may to shall can be pretty big.
Yeah. This is the one that, if I remember correctly, during the committee hearing, we have some questions as to why the term shall was being used. I think Senator Vaca was one, if I remember correctly, that brought up the differences on the may.
Yeah.
And so that's what we have before us. You care?
I'm fine with it.
All right. Any other discussion? Any objection to the motion for the amendment A2 to go into House Bill 2943? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I'll move 2943 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Avakian moves House Bill 2943. I just want to make sure if that's A2, as amended by the, it says A2, but I think it's only the dash 2, because it wasn't an A when it came over to us.
Yeah, it's the dash 2.
So it's an A2.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how we refer to that.
But anyway, we're moving it as amended by this committee to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion on the motion to move to the floor? Any objections? So ordered. And let's see, Senator Avakian on this one?
Yep.
All right, I'm closing the work session on Senate Bill, House Bill 2943. We're opening a public hearing now on House Bill 2891, and if we can get the sheets up on that. Yes.
I'm not going to do 2220.
We're going to come back to it.
Public hearing on 2891. House Bill 2891. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2891 requires the Employment Relations Board to certify a labor organization as the exclusive representative of employees if presented with signed authorization cards by the majority of the employees. Requires rulemaking, including procedures for authenticating cards. There is the dash one amendment, which was on your desk today, and I can speak to that if you so choose.
Why don't you go ahead and speak to it while you're...
The dash one amendment provides the procedure for 30% of the employees to submit a petition to the Employment Relations Board require an election. The election must be held within 45 days, requires rulemaking, including the requirement to file a petition within 14 days, and that's under the situation where there is an election with the certification that the measure talks about initially. That's probably a little bit confusing.
Well, we can go into the public hearing.
Okay.
Looks like we have Tom Chamberlain, Richard
Schwartz.
Is there anybody else? Okay. And John
the Pink?
The pink, is it?
The pink.
Would you like to come up now, too? We have three chairs there.
Oh. Sure. Good afternoon. My name is Tom Chamberlain, and I'm the president of the Oregon AFL-CIO. An employee is fired every 17 minutes in this country for attempting to join a union and collectively bargain. Our union density has decreased over the last 25 years from about 30% to 12%. And the wealth of this country has shifted as well. A recent New York Times article reported that the top 1% of income earners earned as much as the rest of us. And what does that mean? That means that 300,000 families in this country earned as much as the bottom 150 million. And the middle class is shrinking. And there's a direct correlation between the shrinkage of the middle class to union density. And one of the problems we have in this country is it's too hard to join a union. House Bill 2891, majority sign-up, is an expedited election process. It's an election process where the employees form a union by signing union authorization cards. 50% get signed cards, they're automatically recognized as a union. This amendment is limited to public employees only. Our amendment adds an election process, and how it would work is like this. 50% of the employees sign cards to join a union. Within 14 days, if a petition is filed by 30% of the workers, that triggers an election that must be held within 45 days. So the argument that some of the opponents of the bill have expressed in that workers don't have a right to vote. First of all, we don't buy that because the card, authorization card in itself is a means of voting. But for those folks who feel compelled to have an election, there is a trigger, and that 30% signing a petition would trigger an election. Any questions?
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
And those elections are secret ballot?
Yes.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Chamberlain, I'm assuming you kicked off the testimony today. And so, let's see. Mr. Schwartz, have you testified yet?
I have not.
Okay, go ahead, sir.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Richard Schwartz. I'm Executive Director of AFT Oregon. I'm speaking today in support of all three bills that you'll be looking at, House Bill 2891, 92, and 93. But I want to speak specifically in support of House Bill 2891 on majority sign-up. At the outset, I should say that we're in support of the proposed amendments to House Bill 2891. I'd just like to highlight for the members of the committee that majority sign-up is actually a higher standard than an election. Majority sign-up requires that there be exactly what it says, a majority of employees in a proposed bargaining unit before recognition could take place. In the election that many of the opponents of this bill see as the real need, in an election, it's merely a majority of those who cast votes, which can be a number substantially less than an actual majority of the eligible voters, just like in any political election. So in support of this bill, I wanted to make sure that the members of the committee understand that we're actually in advocating majority sign-up, that we're advocating a higher standard in order for representation than the secret ballot election would provide. The idea of voluntary recognition or recognition through majority sign-up is already an element of the statute, both in the public sector and in the private sector, and it's been since the beginning of each of those statutes and the beginning of the Public Employee Collective Bargaining Act. The difference between what is and what's proposed in House Bill 2891 is that it effectively, because it's called voluntary recognition, it effectively gives the employer an opportunity to veto what a majority of employees have designated. In seeking representation, which is the right of individuals under the statute, it's not the right of unions or the right of employers to designate that. It's the right of individuals to choose to form and then to participate in the activities of the organization. They have the public employees have the right to designate a union. If a majority does, and in our case, in all of the cases that we've been involved in, we make the opportunity or request the employer to voluntarily recognize. It's a promise in the statute that goes unfulfilled because routinely public employers reject that notion. In my experience, in over 25 years in this state, I've not run across one case, at least that we've been involved in, where a public employer is actually granted voluntary recognition. I've submitted written testimony which gives examples of the time lag between the time we filed in a number of cases over about a decade in which we filed substantial majorities or requested voluntary recognition recognition with substantial majorities of employees, which were rejected by the employer. And then it took as long as 2 or 3 years later before an election finally took place. In many cases, it was up to a year, but in some cases, it takes even longer for that to be resolved. So we're still advocating for the idea of majority sign-up. We accept the notions put forth in the proposed amendment, if that will satisfy the issues of those opposed to this matter in order to get it through. And as I said, I submitted written testimony, and I'm available for any questions you may have. Thank you.
All right. And is it John? Is it Lipkin?
John Lepink.
Lepink?
Lep with a little pink on it.
All right. Why don't you go ahead and give your testimony, and we'll open up for questions.
Chair Plazonski, fellow chair members, I'm John Lepink. I work for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. I have for 18 years. I am presently a fisheries biologist here in Salem, working at Salem headquarters. I am also a union steward with SEIU 503, Local 109, ODFW. ODFW just recently joined a union, and today I'm here to tell you about what happens when you don't have a lot of opposition or you have somebody intervene in the process of the union organization. But in September of 2002, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife employees and union organizers identified problems within ODFW and a need for organization and a contract to help solve these problems. And the major problem was that people weren't able to talk directly back and forth with management. And we felt through the unionization process we could open up that doorway where management would be more or less forced to talk with the individual employees. So one of the things that made this process easier at ODFW was that the executive director of SEIU negotiated with the governor that the management at ODFW would remain neutral during the organization process. Although this was the official position of ODFW, individual managers did indicate or relayed to a number of their employees that if the union came on, things would get worse and individual employees would not be able to do their job and could possibly suffer because of the support of the union. In spite of that, on April 15th, 2003, 8 months after organization process started, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife employees filed for union election with the State Employee Relations Board. This was through turning in a card, through the card process. And at that time, we had a majority of the employees turn in cards to call for that election. On July 1st of 2003, ODFW employees voted overwhelmingly to form a union. Of those voting, over 80% voted for the union. So, you know, the representative employees then entered into a bargaining. In early December, we had a contract ready for ratification. And January 24th of 2004, the contract was signed. That's 1 year and 8 months after the process started. You know, and I think it was all well worth it. We are have a good relation with our workers, with our supervisors. We have a real active employee relations group, and we're solving problems at the workplace. So it was well worth it. And, you know, the thing about this is we could have had this process in place 6 months earlier if we'd have had just the card check off rather than have to go through election. We could have had this all going faster. Any questions? I'd be glad to answer them.
Thank you. I'll open the panel to questions. Senator Byers first.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to digest this amendment for starters. And so this amendment is, the way I'm reading it, is for lack of a better word, a referendum, so that it's not that the people who want to hold to form a union have to go out and get the signatures. The people who may not want to form a union have to go out and get the signatures.
That's not, Chair Plazonski, Senator Byers, that's not quite correct. Those employees who want an election have to go out and sign a petition. That doesn't necessarily mean they don't want a union.
Okay, I stand corrected on that point. Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So I see that it gives them 14 days in order to get 30% of the signatures. I think, at least that's, I think, the way it's being, I'm reading it correctly. But so my question would be, is there a timeline that the card gatherers have? Do they have to meet a 14-day timeline to gather 50% of the cards of the unit?
Chair Pruszynski, Senator Beyer, the folks who are asking for election don't have a 14-day limit. What occurs is when you begin to collect cards, the employee group knows that there's a union drive occurring. They can begin collecting cards at any time. They just have to file that petition for election, and they can start any time during the organizing drive. They just have to file the petition within 14 days after the union authorization cards have been filed. So there isn't a time limit. They just have to be filed by a certain date, that election petition.
Okay, I think I understand. But so my question, is there a time limit for collecting the signatures on the cards?
There isn't a time limit, but since the employment relation, Chair Pruszynski, Senator Beyer, there isn't a time limit, but since the Employment Relations Board has to authenticate each card along election process through card authorization, doesn't make sense because you have turnover and those cards become stale because those folks may have left that employment. So it's self-limiting.
Okay. Any other questions? Just leave my hand there. Thank you very much. Representative Rosenbaum, did you want to speak on this bill?
Yes, I do, Mr. Chair.
Why don't you come forward? And I don't have any other sign-up sheets here at the moment. Go ahead, please.
And Mr. Vice Chair, you're in hearing on House Bill 2891.
That is correct.
Okay, and I also had comments on the other two bills that are scheduled, 2893 and 2892. Is it possible I could testify to those as well while I'm here? I'm in a committee down the hall.
I know you're in the same committee. I just left. So.
Oh, right.
I won't have any objection to that. If you'd like to speak to all three bills at one time, that's fine with me.
Okay, that would be great. I'm Diane Rosenbaum, State Representative for House District 42 and Speaker Pro Tem of the Oregon House, and I'm also President of the National Labor Caucus of State Legislators, which is a national organization with over 700 legislator members of both parties from virtually all states in the country. And I am here to testify in support of House Bill 2891 and also to offer comments on the other two bills. I think that, you know, one of the things that is great about our state and our nation is that we are protected by the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, but I think it sometimes feels to people like they check that Bill of Rights when they go to work in the morning and then don't regain it until they go home at night. And I think that some of what these bills are meant to deal with is to basically not take sides, but simply to provide a more level playing field when people wish to form a union and encounter obstacles in doing that. The bill in particular that you're hearing right now, House Bill 2891, I think is extremely important because I think that in addition to making people feel somewhat more secure that they actually do have some rights, it also can have the effect of reducing strife in the workplace and unnecessary conflict. And I'll just cite one example to you of how that works in the private sector, although I know this bill deals with the public sector, but my own union that I belong to, the Communications Workers of America, represents people in telecommunications and some other arenas and represent people who work at Singular, which, as we've probably all heard, their commercials are now becoming the new AT&T. But having been the old AT&T and then Singular and changing back, there was an agreement worked out between that corporation and the Communications Workers of America to allow people to sign cards as is called for in this bill, and then when they reached a certain threshold, that the company agreed to recognize the union and negotiate a contract at that point. And that has worked out extremely well, I think, for the benefit of both the employer and the employee in that case, and I'm sure that the corporation, if their representatives were here, would tell you the same thing. Because instead of having to waste a lot of time and energy in hiring lawyers or, you know, just trying to conduct a campaign, they've been able to have people concentrate on getting the work done, doing what's good for the company, at the same time as exercising their rights. And it really has not caused disruption, but in fact, I think has had quite the opposite effect. So I would argue that I think doing something like that, that House Bill 2891 calls for, could well have the same effect of letting people have a process that's fair and above board and concentrate on serving the taxpayers of the state of Oregon at the same time. Right. I also want to offer, Mr. Chair, I had...
I understand. I just want to make sure we have the record set. My understanding, Representative Rosenbaum, you want to give testimony on all three of the bills?
If possible,
so
yes.
I'm going to go ahead and open a joint public hearing at this point to take testimony from Representative Rosenbaum and Representative Hannah. Why don't you go ahead and come up? I understand you also want to give testimony. This is testimony on House Bill 2891, House Bill 2892, House Bill 2893. And for those who are here, because of the schedules that all of us have in this building, it's more of a courtesy, but one I think that's important to make certain that we keep people in the committees they need to be in. So we're going to take the testimony for all three bills from these two elected officials. We're then going to go back into House Bill 2891 and continue. So, Representative Rosenbaum, why don't you finish yours, and then we'll go with Representative Hannah.
Before she leaves 2891, I had just a brief question.
Okay.
Sure. On 2891, have you seen the Dash 1 amendments?
These are new amendments since the bill passed the House.
5-9 is the date.
I have not seen them.
Okay, no. I appreciate your view on those amendments.
And since both of y'all weren't in the room, the chair's intent here is to take only public testimony today on all three of these bills. We're not planning on moving in any of the three today. And so it will give us an opportunity for people to kind of, let's say, take a deep breath, get hold of whatever amendments are out there, and determine whether or not we need anything else before we take any action on any of the bills.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Monroe, I will certainly take a look at them and get back to you. So those were my comments on House Bill 2891.
Right. I tell you what, I'm going to do this. Instead of going through all of your three, Representative Hannah, why don't you go ahead and, if you have testimony on 2891, that way we'll at least have it together for those who are going through the process. You don't?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My testimony is on House Bill 2893.
Okay, hang tight. Senator Rosenbaum, you're on 2892, Representative?
Senator Brown would probably appreciate that correction.
Okay. She's got it.
Thank you. And I will then talk about House Bill 2892. And House Bill 2892 is, I think, a fairly simple bill that just says that taxpayer dollars will not be expended to basically take sides in a union organizing campaign when it is underway. I had the opportunity to carry this bill on the floor of the House, and it did pass the House, as did all of these bills. And I think the really important thing about this is that when we spend taxpayer dollars on projects or contracts or whatever, I think that taxpayers make a reasonable assumption that those dollars are going to go to the project for which they were allocated. I think that as good stewards of those monies that are entrusted to us, it's really our obligation to ensure that they do. And that really is all this bill calls for. You know, it's nothing says that if we have contracts that companies can't use other dollars that they may have in whatever way they see fit that's legal, but they shouldn't be using our monies that we have said are there to build a road or do a remodel or something like that. So really, that's all the bill says, and I think it really is consistent with just being fiscally prudent and making sure that taxpayers have confidence that we're being accountable and transparent with the monies that they have entrusted to us. So I would urge you to really look hard at that bill and hopefully to support it. And then finally, House Bill 2893, which is a bill that I do think deals with the first thing I mentioned, the basic rights that I think everybody in this country believes that they have, you know, the right to freedom of speech and also not to be subjected to being forced to listen to political speech or religious speech, although I understand there may be some amendments to that portion of the bill, that they don't voluntarily choose to and that aren't directly related to their work. And really, that's all that bill says, is that, you know, if employers choose to hold meetings for purposes that are in those arenas, primarily political in nature, and that would include dealing with unionization or their own opinions about that, that they can do that and people can be there, but people cannot be forced to do that. And it's interesting because I actually did sit on the committee that's the corresponding committee to yours when these bills were heard in the House, and we had testimony about the very things I'm talking about the Bill of Rights and about the First Amendment, and that it really would infringe on First Amendment rights to say that these meetings can't be held in the way that the bill attempts to restrict. And I know that we all have the freedom to say what we want about things, but I've never heard that, in addition to being able to tell you what I think, I can also force you to sit here and listen to me at the same time. Although, I suppose under a call of the House, that sometimes does happen. But that situation...
Never would happen on a call of the Senate, that's for sure.
That situation notwithstanding, generally people have the right to say what they want, but other people have the right to listen or to choose to leave if they wish to. And that really, I think, is consistent with what this bill is asking for. So I would urge you to take a good look at all three of these bills and hopefully to pass them to the Senate. And I hope the Senate looks favorably, as did the House. Thank you very much, and I'd be happy to answer any further questions.
All right. I think what I'm going to do is go ahead and let questions be asked of Representative Rosenbaum on 92 and 93, and then if you need to leave, you can go ahead and leave, and then we'll take testimony from us, Representative Hanna. And it looks like Ms. Representative Greenland is here, too. Which bill or bills are you? 92 and 93. Looks like we have a spare seat up here. Questions first for Representative Rosenbaum.
Yeah, Diane, I've gotten correspondence from people that believe that 2893 might be construed to prohibit the Senate and the House from starting their proceedings with an invocation. Was that discussed?
That was, Mr. Chair and Senator Monroe, that was raised in the debate in the House, and in fact, I think the answer is very clearly that the bill does not do that. And I will say, in particular in the House, the way we are operating is that people, there is no requirement, for one thing, that you be on the floor or even that there be a quorum when we have those opening ceremonies. So if people choose not to be there, they don't have to be there. No one is required to be there, but it's very clear to us that this bill would not interfere with the ability to have those opening ceremonies. So I don't think it has any effect whatsoever.
Thank you for that explanation, because I, for one, and I know several other of my fellow senators, kind of enjoy the variety of wisdom that we get from a variety of clergy people and church leaders from all walks of life to start our day. Sometimes it can be very helpful, I think.
All right. Any other questions? No, you can't. Not yet. I want to clear her out, and then we're going to take other testimony.
Clear her. That's good.
Yeah. I've got a little process here, so if you'll bear with me. Any other questions? Representative, you're free to take off if you need to take off.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
All right. And Senator Hanna was here first.
Representative Hanna.
So Representative Hanna's here first, and so then Representative Greenlick will let you enter into the discussion, but I want to give everyone the courtesies that's first come, first serve. Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, I'm Bruce Hanna, State Representative from House District 7, represent vast portions of Eastern Douglas and Lane counties. I'm here to discuss House Bill 2893. Which I believe contains language that simply goes too far. The bill in its current form appears to encroach on rights of free speech and freedom to practice one's religion. I understand that there are amendments that address the religious issues, so I will confine my comments to the political speech portions of the bill. As many of you know, I am an employer, and I believe this bill could have a chilling effect on routine business communications about all kinds of matters of importance to employees. For example, under the definition of political matters, an employer could be banned from discussing campaigns for legislation. I believe this would prohibit an employee from having a clear and concise discussion on pending legislation that would affect business operations. In my business, we have many mandatory meetings, and I use that term loosely as they are paid employee meetings, on employee benefits. We often bring in paid experts to brief our employees on possible effects of pending legislation from both the state and federal level. Frankly, stopping these types of discussions and trainings would be detrimental to my employees, and it simply may be against the law under House Bill 2893 as it is currently written. My staff and I currently or regularly deal with grocers and retailers who often have concerns over the outcome of legislation and some that's currently under consideration in this body. Even if I weren't a legislator, it would be critical for myself and my staff to inform our customers about the possible outcomes under discussion of these legislative issues affecting their business. Other issues also come to mind with this bill. For instance, how would a school board communicate to its employees the impact of budget issues or content of education legislation, such as the SEM-CAM debate we had earlier this session, and give that district's opinion of how they would handle the pending legislative change? These concerns are simply examples that illustrate the greater fundamental issue of free speech that may be severely limited by this bill. I feel quite certain that it was not the intent of the proponents of this bill to limit free speech and religion. However, this bill may just do that. For these reasons, I would urge you to vote no and oppose this bill. However, if you must go forward with some version of this bill, I ask that you consider the -3 amendments I've provided to the committee administrator today. My office spent considerable time with legislative counsel discussing how to protect both employers and employees' free speech rights. I believe the -3 amendments will give reasonable protection to both sides. The -3 amendments do three main things. One, they protect an employer's ability to communicate their opinions by allowing communication on political and religious matters. Two, at the same time, it allows employees to opt out of a meeting or communication that concerns politics or religion. And finally, it prohibits an employer from taking disciplinary action because that employee refused to participate. I believe this provides a balanced approach to the competing interests of the bill. I respectfully request that you thoroughly vet the -3 amendments and urge their adoption. Thank you.
All right. Senator Avakian.
Representative, thank you for coming to the committee. It's helpful to have your testimony. I'm reading the -3 amendment, and I'm having, a couple questions. First, I'm not understanding how it differs from the original bill, since both allow the employer to call a meeting and both allow the employee to choose not to attend. And so I'm not seeing the difference. And if you could just help the committee and I with that.
In discussing this with legislative counsel, it appears the difference is what would happen downstream from the event if the compelling portion of the meeting were such that the employee felt compelled by pay to be there versus not. So it's downstream from the actual event that it might be different.
And one more, if I might, Mr. Chair.
You may.
In the dash 3 amendment, it says that there's this sentence on line 4 that says, if the subject of the meeting or communication or a portion is to communicate the employer's opinion, the employee may refuse to attend. What would happen in a situation where the employer wasn't the one giving an opinion but invited some other third group in? I don't know, committee to da-da-da-da-da in order to express that group's opinion. Is it your intent that the employee be able to opt out of that kind of meeting as well?
Well, during discussion on the House floor, it's my understanding from the carrier's opinion that paid opinion purchased for by the company would then become, in effect, the employer's opinion. And so that's why I use that as one of the examples. To provide an opportunity for someone to come and give opinion, I think the good news is the employee has the opportunity to opt out of that opportunity.
Okay, so that would be your intent behind this, is that in that situation, the employee not be required to attend either.
And I think that's the part where the compelled to be there is the difference. They're being paid to be there. In the examples I cite, one would be an employee benefits meeting at which the employer would be paying employees, therefore compelling them, and the other might be a safety meeting where they would also be compelled to be there. So they'd still have the opportunity to opt out of that event.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, I'd like to go along the same line, Representative Hanna. What if there's a ballot measure that's up and the employer has strong views on that and calls a meeting and allows the pro or the con group to come in voluntarily without any pay, come in and speak on that ballot measure? Does the employee have the right to walk out even if they're not paid?
Well, if they're not paid, they have the right not to come and or to walk out.
Well, what if the employer calls a mandatory meeting? Employer calls a mandatory meeting, and in there is a group that's arguing, say, for or against Measure 36 or some other controversial measure, and the employees show up, and the presentation starts. Can they walk out?
Well, first of all, I think you got a different section of the law there to say that an employer could have a required mandatory meeting without the employee being paid.
No, I think the question was supposed to be the guest coming in is doing it without pay.
Yeah.
But the employee is still on the books and is on the clock.
Then I think the same logic applies. They still have the opportunity to walk out without retribution.
That would be very important, I think.
Yeah.
Okay. Senator Barr, did you have a question?
No.
I couldn't tell. All right. Representative Hanna, thank you very much regarding your testimony. And you're free to stay here if you like. Representative Greenlick, if you want to go back to answer the question that was asked on 2892, feel free to do that. And then give us your perspective on those two bills as well.
It was 2893, I think.
Well, the first one was it?
Yeah, the question.
The last question, when he was just coming in, I was asking Diane about 2393.
Okay, fair enough.
Thank you. I'm State Representative Mitch Greenlick, House District 33. I appreciate your giving me the opportunity to testify on House Bill 2893, and I'll keep talking as long as my voice holds up. Well, not that long.
Considering the number of people behind you, you might want to take that into consideration.
I do want to speak very briefly. I support 2893 as it is currently written. The point that was made over and over in the debate on the House floor was we were talking about meetings that were a condition of employment. And it seems to me both political, one ought not be compelled for a variety of reasons to attend meetings on political content as a matter of employment, but it seems particularly important not to force one to attend a religious meeting as a condition of employment. Now, the rumor that we're in violation came from a speech I made on the floor. I was happy to take that opportunity to continue to press a point that I had been making for three terms now, and that's a request to move the roll call to after the opening ceremony. It's my impression, even though a quorum isn't recorded until after the opening ceremony and courtesies, that as long as my constituents hear my name called in the roll and I'm not there, then I perceive psychologically as a condition of employment, I need to be there. And when I need to be there, it violates my First Amendment, Oregon constitutional First Amendment rights to worship as I please. Because if I'm forced as a matter of my employment, my constituents, who I consider my employers, expect me to be there, then I want to be there. And when I'm missing every roll call, as I'm doing now, I can imagine a political hit piece that I'm never there for any of these roll calls. I think we have the right, there's no question, we have the right to have prayer or anything else as a part of opening ceremonies. What I want, as a practicing member of a religion, other than the one that's most likely worshipped at the hearing, is the right not to have to be there as a condition of my employment. So I was only, I simply took that opportunity to make a point I've been trying to make, which is I believe the roll call should be after. Of course, the argument about not having the roll call after the opening ceremony is that nobody will come if you don't do the roll call. And that's exactly my point. My point is the roll call compels them to come. That's why they're there. And if if you didn't do the roll call and nobody came, then you would know for sure that it was a voluntary meeting and it wasn't, that the worship was on a voluntary basis and not as a condition of my employment. So I do not think either the House or the Senate have to stop doing opening ceremonies, and I think I was the source of that concern. But I do think it's really important to make sure that that employers cannot compel, as a matter of employment, their employees to attend a religious meeting. And to me, that's a violation of the American Constitution. I think it's a violation of federal employment statutes. And it seems to me the -1 amendments take away the explicit notion of that protection in Oregon statute. So I would urge you to pass the bill unamended, at least without striking the religious requirement from the bill. And I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Question, Senator Monroe.
Yeah, well, thanks for coming, Mitch. I appreciate your input. We have, it's been a long time since I was in the House. I was once, but in the Senate, we have had opening, sometimes it's a prayer, sometimes it's a recitation, from Jewish leaders, Catholic leaders, and every kind of flavor of Protestant leaders, American Indian leaders, and Islamic leaders, so far this year, all of them. And I've appreciated that because they all have somewhat different points of view, and to me, it's been a beneficial thing. I always have the right, though, after the roll call, after they put my name up on the board, I can turn right around and walk out. And I did that once about 25 years ago because the person that was going to give the opening prayer was the Rajneeshi guy. And I thought they were evil. I thought, and I didn't want to hear what they had to say.
Yeah,
so,
once the Wicca folks also caused a lot of people.
Well, I was saddened that they were invited. They were pushing their political agenda at that time on the legislature big time, whining and dining legislators, taking them over to Rajneeshpuram and showing them a good time. I refused to do that too. So I think, there are times when somebody may come to do the presentation that I may be so may object to in such a degree that I'll turn around and walk out. I have a right to do that.
But my point is that I don't care if it's a rabbi who's my best friend and is at a temple that I choose to go to on Friday night or Saturday, which actually happens. I don't care if that's who's there. The fact is, my freedom to decide how I worship can't be conditioned by my employment. And you might notice I tend to sit at my desk. I don't like to not be there for votes. I don't like to not be there for roll call. I think my constituents expect me to be there. Yeah. And I do find out what the opening ceremony is. And when it's worship, I choose not to come. And I don't think there's anything statutorily that compels me to be there. But I think psychologically, I am impelled to be there.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
May I make a couple brief comments just to this issue? Much of the discussion is related to the employment of legislators in this conversation. And during our House debate and thereafter, lots of the discussion was not about those who have the opportunity or choice to come and go from the body as we have, but those who are paid to be there, including the security staff, the Senate and House chamber folks who actually run the meeting. So that piece, those folks are compelled to be there because they're paid employees. And furthermore, I might just add on this piece that as it applies to House Bill 2893, which would prohibit an employer from requiring an employee to attend a meeting or participate in communication if the purpose of the meeting or the communications is to communicate the employer's opinion about religions. So legislative counsel has come back and said, this test appears to be more broadly limit communications by an employer about religious matters, and legislative prayer could be interpreted as requiring an employer, such as the Legislative Assembly, to be far more careful about the content of the prayer to ensure that the prayer is not representative of the employer's opinion about religious matters. This matter is so subjective that it would be difficult to prove and could lead to the Legislative Assembly's limiting session prayers to avoid liability.
All right, anything else? Gentlemen, thank you very much. I'm going to close this portion of the public hearing, which was for 2891, 2892, and 2893. I'm going to reopen the general public hearing on House Bill 2891, get back to our witness registration.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you all very much. The next three in the panel I have is Grover Simmons, Bill Perry, and Anna Campion, maybe?
Campion.
We'll go in the order that I called. Mr. Simmons, you'll go first, Bill second, and Anna will be third.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Grover Simmons, and I represent the adult foster home providers who are members of the Independent Adult Foster Home Association. The first issue I'd like to raise, which is not in my printed testimony, is the issue of standing. This bill talks in terms of public employers and public employees and refers to a section of the ORS relating to public employment and so forth. Well, currently, adult foster homes are not public employees. However, Senate Bill 858, which your committee voted to send to rules last week, addresses that exact point. If I may read it, just a couple of lines. It says, for purpose of collective bargaining under ORS such and such, the state of Oregon is the public employer of record of adult foster care home providers. Next line, adult foster care home providers are considered to be public employees governed under ORS 243.650 to 243.782. So that would bring the entire industry under the jurisdiction of House Bill 2891. So while that's a highly technical point, I think that it's relevant because we want to testify in opposition to 2891. And there are seven other witnesses who are prepared to testify if that were possible. But
let me tell you where we're at. We've got 25 minutes before our time's out for this committee. We're going to run a little bit longer than that. and the chair's going to take the prerogative of two-minute testimony.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So our association opposes the bill because it eliminates the fundamental right to a secret ballot election when a union is organizing people in a collective bargaining unit. This card check bill flies in the face of traditional labor law when it takes away the right of a person to vote privately for or against union representation, free of intimidation, coercion, harassment, manipulation, and misrepresentation. In the past few weeks, all of these conditions have happened to the adult foster home providers throughout Oregon. SEIU Local 503's campaign has found union organizers at the door, inside the homes, on the telephone, badgering owners of foster homes to sign authorization cards. Witnesses are here today to relate how they have been lied to and harassed in their own home. There are nearly 1,700 homes in Oregon, 500 in Multnomah County, approximately, and a vast majority are Romanians, owned and operated by Romanians. So while Romanians are wonderful caregivers and take excellent care of our mothers and fathers and elderly Oregonians, they are generally unfamiliar with labor law and the fine points of unionization.
Mr. Simmons, I'm going to call your time. I've been giving you about 4 minutes at this point. I know I didn't give you a fair warning before, so that's why I gave you another minute and a half.
Okay. So, anyway, we think this bill is takes away a civil right, the right to vote, and some of us were around in the 1950s and
60s. Mr. Simmons, thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you.
Mr. Perry?
Can I ask a question before? Can I
you
also
may.
Speak to 2893? I think I'll get them both within my 2 minutes and not have to have them signed up for both.
All right.
Is that appropriate?
You bet.
For the record, Bill Perry at the Oregon.
I tell you what I'm going to do. Because of our time, I'm going to go ahead and open a public hearing on all three of the bills at this point, so those who are doubled up on signing can do so, but realize because of the number of people I have on this list, I want to give everyone an opportunity to testify, so we are limiting your testimony to 2 minutes.
Okay. For the record, Bill Perry at the Oregon Restaurant Association, and basically I think some of the issues that revolve around this are intimidation, and I think you guys as members of this board really don't have an idea where it's coming from, and neither do I. I mean, it could come from different places. We've seen elections work, both of the example of the Fish and Wildlife, and I think also at the lottery where they've had an election or had a discussion and turned down the union. But one of the problems is that the employees need protection, and they generally need information in larger audiences. They talk about different, we've even talked about Senate Bill 403 that was in this committee inside employee meeting where they were able to talk about what a rest or meal period break would do and how it would be implemented. And so the issue is not where the communication exists, it is the communication. If intimidation happens, we need to fix that. But there are many forms of communication that can happen in these public forums instead of the one-on-one meetings, which is when intimidation happens. In my restaurants, it's people coming in and hand flyers to my employees. It's people catching them outside the door, or it could be the employer attacking them. But if you have them in a group setting, they feel more comfortable, they are better able to receive information, and that way they have other witnesses so you can tell if there is intimidation or dishonesty or anything else. So you're taking away under 91 and 93 the public forums of information that I think are needed to protect all employees, and it's the only way you can find out if there is intimidation happening is in a public forum, because it's hearsay if it's one-to-one, which is these bills are going to force it all to be one-to-one communication. Did I make it under 2 minutes?
You did. You actually have 16 seconds left over. Mr. Perry, you get the gold star. Thank you. And let's see. Is it Campion. Campion.
Mm-hmm. Senator Przewodniczący and members of the committee, thank you for giving me this time to speak. I'll just read this really quick. The signatures that were obtained from the adult care home providers should be verified with great scrutiny. There are numerous providers that have contacted the union, the SEIU Local 503, I think, by phone or other avenues, and they have asked for their cards back, but have not yet received them back. The union reps tried to further convince them to not to retrieve their cards. Some providers have waited over 2 weeks and still have not received their signatures back. Recently, the union is asking the providers to provide them with a written letter asking for the signatures back. Others have left messages and not received the return phone call. Others have even been hung up on. We just simply want our signatures back if we've signed already and we have a change of heart and a change of mind. There is an abundance of confusion within our community, and from the misrepresentation on the one-on-one basis, from the misleading our community. I have no words to describe the confusion, the panic that many providers are faced with. Numerous providers that have contacted me personally are extremely frustrated because they feel like the union reps just don't get the point. Our community has been bombarded in the last couple of months with union representatives knocking on our doors during meal times, which is the most busiest times of our days, on Saturdays and even Sundays. Give us a break, please. Many providers have reps knocking on their doors, disrupting their day up to 7 times. This type of soliciting is outrageously intimidating to our providers, to the providers in our community. Most people said at the doors that they are not interested, but as the reps insisted on entering the home just for a minute, that minute turned into 3 hours at my brother's house, for example. As if that wasn't enough, they started calling providers several times, insisting of our support. Despite of our Eastern European background, the community now understands what the union is about. We don't want to become employees of the state, and we don't want to owe union dues and so on and so on. We are privately owned businesses, small businesses. We do not want to become mini institutions. Our families are there because they want us the way we are currently run.
Thank you very much.
I can say more and more, but
I appreciate what you shared very much. I want to thank the panel for coming forward. Let me ask if there's any questions for anyone.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Gordley.
Yes, I would like to know, not from the panel, but from those in the room who could answer the question, what is the plan to respond directly to those folks who have requested to get their cards back? What is the plan? I'd like to know that.
All right. Good question. And what we're going to do is, for everyone that's giving testimony, I know that I've limited it to 2 minutes at this point. Realize that the record is going to stay open. If you have other things that you'd like to say that you aren't able to do within your 2 minutes of speaking, write it down, email it electronically, or handwrite it, however it is, and get it to either myself as the chair or to our committee administrator, and we'll make sure everyone gets it. So I want to make sure everyone understands that you still have the right to give us more information. We're just limited today as to how much we can take here during this period.
Mr. Chair, really brief. I just have a simple, quick list of some of the names and some of the providers that I've talked to that have called and asked for their cards. But we can obtain more names that want their cards back. It's just we can't get through to the union to just give us our signatures back.
Right. And so if you'll deliver that information, that'll be something that Senator Gordley has put a question forward. We'll get an answer from those individuals who are proponents for this type of a system. All right, with that said, the next three panelists we have is Karen Campbell, Adrian Nicola, I can't tell the last name.
Nicola.
Okay, and then Monica Hatta.
So I'll get going quickly. Thank you for
all
your
right.
time.
Thank you.
Hello, my name is Karen Campbell. I've been a licensed owner-operator of an adult foster home in the state of Oregon for 22 years. Thank you for the opportunity to express my concerns in regards to the tactics of the union organizers are using. I've chosen to bullet point this information as it provides a clearer picture of what is actually happening to me and other providers. I will share with you only one experience, although I have had contact with 7 different times by 7 different organizers to solicit my endorsement on the organization card. One of the union organizers stated that he was here on behalf of the state of Oregon. 2, I can only assume that the representative was from SEIU 503 because I was refused proper identification when I was asked for it. The union organizer stated that the home care providers got a huge pay raise, and I'm sure we can do the same for the adult foster home providers. The union organizer asked me, don't you want to make more money? The union organizer stated the union will provide 100% health, dental, vision, insurance, funding for relief staffing. Wouldn't you like a vacation? When I asked what the financial impact would be on the independent owner-operator, the union organizer told me to open my eyes and look at the benefits of what the union could provide to me. and that I need not be ignorant and take time to understand the bill. I stated, this is what I just asked you. I was told I was narrow-minded, obviously didn't understand the long-term care and what the industry has been up against with equal pay for equal work from the state. Excuse me. And if I didn't sign the union organization card, I would be hurting the industry as a whole. I stated you haven't provided me with documentation. I also stated unionizing is a very serious decision and deserves due diligence. He then stood up and said to me, you are not a very bright woman. The union organizer attempted manipulating me into signing the card by intimidation. I again asked the union organizer to explain how this will benefit me, owner-operator, and how it will help my residents. He diverted my question. I then asked the union organizer for a copy of the bill. He stated he didn't have any more, and I asked if he would please, he asked me if I would just please sign the card, and I will leave. At this point, I asked him to leave, and he started the dialogue all over. He stated, let me try to explain to you what the union will benefit and will allow you to continue to stay into business. I called another employee to come into the office when we directed him to the door. His closing statement was, it's people like you that hurt small business. I then quietly shut the door and locked it. In closing, I would like to say, I find the approach of the union organizer not only to be unprofessional, rude, insulting, intimidating, as well as assuming I'm not well-versed in long-term care, as I've worked very hard for 22 years in community-based long-term care. Thank you once again for your time and consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Campbell.
Was that 2 minutes?
It's actually 2 minutes and 20 seconds, but you're on that roll, and I wanted to make sure you got it done. All right. Adrian?
Yes. Well, I'm not much of a speaker. I probably don't need 2 minutes. I just want to tell you how I found out about union. And that was about 3 weeks ago when I got the phone.
For the record, I just need you to say your name.
My name is Adrian Nicora, and I own an adult care home. I got the phone call 3 weeks ago, and somebody was calling my name, and obviously they had my phone number, and I said, well, we're calling you in behalf of your union. And I said, beg your pardon, well, I'm calling you in behalf of your union. Is that a union I'm a member and I'm not aware of? I said, well, yeah, you're an adult care home union. You know, and I asked for his name and phone number so I can call back. And he started, you know, talking me around, and then, sir, please, I just need your name and phone number so I can read you back. He hung up on me. I don't feel like this is transparent, and I don't feel like a union like this can, you know, is going to gain my trust. I don't trust people like this. Days later, somebody came in my house from the union, and I didn't want to talk to them. It's like you kick them out to the door, they come to the window. I'm sorry. This is not the union I want for myself.
All right. Thank you.
Hello, Senators. I'm Monica Hada, and I oppose the Bill 2891. And I just want to say that as adult care providers, we are very educated, and we understand what the union is. And we know that for some businesses, it's a beneficial thing. So we're not here to trash the union or anything, but we know that for adult care home businesses, it's not beneficial. It just does not go with us. We pride in running our own businesses with excellence, with compassion, and with integrity. And I had a union representative come to me. It was during a time where it was really busy, and I really feel like she completely misled me. She came over and she just said, would you like increased Medicaid, you know, rates? And this is the platform she stood on. As I asked other questions, she kept going back to that same thing. And of course, if we could all say in one voice, we want higher Medicaid rates because we feel like we're barely making it. If I didn't love this business so much, I would find another more lucrative business to work in. So it's not about the money. I love the people I care about, and I love the families. And all of my patients are Medicaid because I choose to serve the community, not just refuse Medicaid patients and just get the people who pay me more. So I feel like she really spoke on what my heart ached. You know, we would like more money. We want equal pay for equal work. And also later, I had facts. After I informed myself, I researched it more, and I thought, you know, the union is just not going to be good for our businesses. We want it the way it is, a home family business. I faxed them a letter saying, because they said you can't just verbally ask back your authorization card. So I faxed him a letter saying my name, my address, my signature, absolutely everything, to please send me back my authorization card, and I still haven't gotten it back. That's what they told me to do. I also got a phone call from the union again, and they said that if I was in favor of $2 million for the adult care home facility, and I said, well, in favor for what? And they said, to increase education. I said, to increase education for us as providers and caregivers or for the union? She would not answer me. I said, I just want to know. I said, to make things clear, I just am not in agreement with the union. And all she said is, thank you very much, and hung up. So is that it? And so I feel discriminated against, first, as a woman, and second, as a we're multicultural, and I feel like we don't have a voice. It's like we just want our cards back, and they think we're not educated enough or we don't understand what we do. We just want our cards back, and that's all.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Thank you very much for coming forward. Our next panel includes I believe it's Olympia Sotaccio, maybe? Sotaccio. Oh, great, thank you. Tudor Rocha? Roshu? And then Bill Bishop. Or, excuse me, Bruce Bishop. You ready?
Yes, I'm here today to let you know that I have all.
Name first.
My name is Olympia Sotaccio, and I thank you very much for this opportunity to speak in the behalf of our Romanian community. And I'm here especially because I have seen all the advantage that the union has taken of our community just because we were not familiar with the unions. I have personally studied unions in U.S. history, and I do acknowledge that they have helped the workers at the beginning, but it seems like in our situation, it will not be a good idea because, first of all, it will hurt the industry, that it will hurt the older population which prefer foster homes over nursing homes, and thirdly, is going to affect, negatively impact the state's budget because the state will have to pay more money for the people that will end up in the nursing home as a result of the foster homes, you know, refusing to take Medicaid residents. So I really believe that we should have a voice in, you know, getting our signatures back or having an election or however having the opportunity to make an informed decision. I have pointed this out to the representatives that came to my home, but they only told me what they thought I will buy into. And I have tried to explain to them that historically only employers unionize, and we are, employees, and we are employers. We want to maintain our independent contractor status and being employers only, not employees. The state has enough problems to deal with. Why have to deal with us as public employees, and we can bargain through the association. We don't have to go through the union exactly. So I really believe this is crucial for the state of Oregon not to allow that to happen to the foster home industry.
Okay, thank you. Tudor?
My name is Tudor Roshu, Mr. Chair, Senators. I'm a foster home business owner, and I've been in this business for 1 year. What I feel about this card signatures is that we're trying to be manipulated because they're trying to come in the house like to talk to us one-to-one person that they can tell anything about that. So they come into my house also, but I was informed, and I actually asked them several questions. They didn't answer very well on them, so I said I'll not send any card. But from the matter point of view, as a theory of democracy and freedom of decision, I feel that if we don't have elections on this matter, that will trespass fundamentals of democracy and free decision. So I will say what they do in this case is like selling techniques, one-point sale. They come into the house, they can mislead, they can misinform, they can omit facts, but then people don't have any chance to change their mind. Because in between the point they come into the house and between the point of elections, people can get more information and may change their mind, but they want to just trespass that. So I have friends that told me that people from union told them a month ago that union will represent us because we don't have anybody to represent. There is an association, actually, has been in place for 15 years. So was this, if it's not twisting of the truth in the front of possible members of the people that are reaching out? So just because there's a possibility of manipulating in this, we should keep the elections as mandatory for this process. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop, appearing this afternoon on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems in opposition to House Bill 2891, 2892, and 2893. I've submitted testimony for the committee detailing the reasons that the Hospital Association is opposed to those three legislative proposals, and I would like to try to beat Bill Perry's 1 minute and
46 seconds
by addressing all three bills, but I'm afraid I'm not going to make it. The Hospital Association opposes House Bill 2891 because it imposes additional restrictions on public employees and employers in the way that they decide whether to be represented by a labor organization. The bill would remove the right of public employees to have an election by secret ballot to decide whether they want to be represented. It would allow the Employment Relations Board to adopt rules that contain guidelines and procedures, but it doesn't allow the board to enforce those guidelines and procedures, nor does it restrict the practices that can be adopted beyond those guidelines and procedures. It would allow the board to establish the authenticity of signed cards, but it does not require that those authorizations, once obtained, be valid. And it does not allow a worker to rescind his or her authorization. Once signed, an authorization card can be counted towards the majority requirement to mandate certification of the labor organization. House Bill 2891 weakens the rights of public employees to decide whether they should be represented by a labor organization. It promotes ill-defined practices that may result in employee intimidation, and it substantially limits employees' current rights to secret ballot elections. Some of the ways in which those organizing techniques may be misused is explained in an edit in an Oregonian article that I've attached to the testimony concerning recent events that have occurred in state. With regard to 2892, the Hospital Association opposes that bill, which would be a limitation on the use of state funds for union organizing. We have two reasons for that opposition. First, similar laws have been adopted in other states. They are now in court being challenged. They are at the appellate level based on challenges in both California and New York. We believe it's not necessary for Oregon to adopt a law while its legality is being considered. Second, the bill has numerous holes in its terminology and application that will make it difficult to administer. I've detailed these in my written testimony, but the real question is, what is a state fund, and does a state fund retain that designation forever, or is there some limitation? The bill is not clear in that regard.
Bishop, I'm going to ask you to kind of summarize. I know that you can make appointments with everyone here if you haven't already, and we are pretty much over that 2 minutes.
Thank you very much.
Right. Thank you. Did you want to make a closing comment on 93? You haven't said anything on that. I'll let you do that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We are opposed to House Bill 2893. We think it's a substantial limitation on political communications. The bill also has terminology and other complications that will make it very difficult to understand, to administer, and the result of that will be a chilling on communications between employers and employees. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. I'm going to temporarily close the public hearings on House Bill 2891, House Bill 2892, and House Bill 2893. I'm going to open a work session at this point on House Bill 2200. This is the last of our work session bills that we skipped over.
2220.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2220 allows it's the pawnbroker bill that allows the Department of Consumer and Business Services to establish the frequency of examinations for pawnbrokers and allows electronic records It eliminates the requirement that the pawnbroker reside in Oregon and eliminates the posting requirements. Thank you, Ms. Oh, there's a dash one amendment. I think we've seen this before, but it did change the redemption of the pawn ticket if it's lost or stolen from not less than 3 days nor more than 5 days to not more than 5 days. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Romaine, why don't you come up, if you would. And I forget the gentleman that's in the back who came to say something to me. I'll forget your name. If you'll please come up. And then David, if you'll come up. I've asked the gentleman to come up forward because prior to us getting started, one of the individuals here, I apologize, he'll identify himself, had some issues as to the bill and some amendments. I've had an opportunity to step out and speak to Mr. Romaine and to the representative from DCBS, and I want to go ahead and just get a couple things on the record. Mr. Romaine, why don't you go ahead and start?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I represent the Oregon Pawnbrokers Association. You want everybody to go on the record? Or?
No.
Okay. We worked with the department to come up with 2220. The dash one amendments are just a furtherance of that work. It's a good bill. It just simplifies the process, as I stated in the public hearing. The dash one amendment, to just explain, right now we have to wait at least 3 days, not more than 5 days, before we take action if there's a lost ticket. It makes no sense for us to have to wait 3 days if we know the person who we're giving the merchandise back to. We should be able to do it immediately. So it's our liability if we mess up. So we're asking just for a little more freedom there. That's all it is. Simple right. Amendment should pass. Now, there were two other issues that the chair brought up to me. One of them dealt with a lost ticket fee. It would be a new fee that would be charged of $2. While in theory we're not opposed to that, we have not had a chance to vet that with our group. So, you know, that is something we might come back to you next session with and say it would be fine. But I don't see, anytime you want to give us more money, that's fine with us. we're usually okay with that. The second part deals with taking the 30-day grace period out of the loan period, making it a 60-day period without a 30-day grace period. And there are, I believe we would probably be in favor of that to some degree, but I think the department has some real problems with that because, in effect, you're taking away something from the consumer. So we, you know, obviously from our industry standpoint, we might differ, but I think we're trying to work with the department on it.
All right. And before we go to the department, sir, if you'll re-identify yourself, I apologize.
Gerald Upshaw.
All right, Mr. Upshaw, I wanted you to come up because I had an opportunity to talk to Mr. Romaine, who is the person representing the Pawnbrokers Association. The concern that has been raised to me, and we're going to hear from DCBS as well, is that the amendments that you gave to me this afternoon are, let's say, a movement away from what had already been agreed to. We're at the stage at the of this legislative session that I'm not real comfortable trying to move new amendments, and understanding that the one regarding the 30-day period may actually have a significant impact on consumers. And what I have gotten through my discussions with the department as well as Mr. Romaine is that they're more than willing to work through this during the interim period. And I can't promise that we'll be able to look at this next February because we are going to have a legislative session, but I'm not sure if we're doing what, if anything, we're doing in the way of policy bills. But during the interim, we're willing to look at it, and I've gotten that commitment. But I just wanted you to come up and hear that from me on the record so individuals would understand where we're at on this. And, David, I apologize, your last name.
Mr. Chair, David Tapman.
Tapman, I apologize. Mr. Tapman, did you need to add anything regarding the concerns that you would have as representative of DCBS as to these, trying to entertain these last-minute amendments at this time?
Mr. Chair, I would like to add a couple of things. Mr. Romaine did fairly characterize the circumstances from our perspective. The proposal that Mr. Upshaw has put forward on the forfeiture of pledge would raise a number of issues. I think this is a relatively finely balanced situation between the consumer using the services and the pawnbroker itself. It is highly complex, as he points out. I would be the first to acknowledge that. I just don't think this is the time and place to try and resolve that high complex issue. We would love to sit down and talk with the industry and the representatives of the industry during the interim session. We meet periodically with Mr. Romaine and his association. In fact, there was just a meeting last Sunday that we attended, and so I would echo what you said, Mr. Chair, that we would be more than willing to work on this during the interim. The other issue was about the loss of pawn tickets. We would also be willing to hear that, but I think it's before we make a decision on that, we'd like to hear the breadth of the problem and learn a little bit more in terms of detail and information rather than make a decision here today.
All right. Mr. Upshaw, I know I haven't given you much to say at this point. I just wanted to put some stuff on the record. Mr. Tapman, with the DCBS, will be a point person for you to contact and work with, as well as Mr. Romaine, as to having some dialogue in the future regarding this. At this point, I'm not comfortable shutting the process down on this bill, knowing the time that we have is about 2 weeks, and our committee is scheduled not to meet next week, and because that's going to really jam our schedule. And at this point, I'm going to go ahead and take a motion on this bill. But before I do that, did you have anything that you wanted to say to us before we move forward on the bill?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. We recently have completed the pawn application process, and we started doing the pawn loans April 15th. And during that short period of time, both of these issues have certainly popped up for us. The one on the theft of the ticket, there's a lot of additional labor involved in processing that. You have to store it separately. There's a lot of issues with it, plus the conflicts that could come up later on if someone else came in with a ticket that had previously been lost, since it's totally negotiable. The other on the 30 days, if you read that section, it is really confusing in that the additional 30-day grace period is only on the initial loan period. It's a 60-day loan with a 30-day period. When you renew that loan, then there is no grace period, and I'm greatly concerned that our customers will assume that it continues through there and will end up losing some of their pledged items. So it's not just a concern for me, it's a concern for our customers. And we did become a pawn shop at the direction of the DCBS.
All right. Well, thank you for putting those words on the record. As I said, at this point, this is a much bigger issue than I'm willing to try to tackle in the next week and a half. Senator Gordley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Upshaw, where are you from and where is your business located?
I have two businesses. One is in Albany and the other is in Springfield.
All right. Thank you.
Any other comments or questions? If not, the chair is willing to take a motion on the Dash 1 amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1 amendments to the House Bill 2220.
Are we in work session?
We are. Senator Beyer has moved the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2220. Is there any further discussion? Any objection? So order.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2220 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Beyer moves House Bill 2220 as amended by the Dash 1s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any further discussion? Any objection? No order. And Senator Beyer, would you carry this one?
Sure.
And Senator Beyer will be our carrier. We'll close the work session on 2220. We're going to reopen our public hearings on the three bills that we have before us, which are House Bill 2891, House Bill 2892, and House Bill 2893. We've gone through the first list of those who were wanting to testify on House Bill 2191. I'm going to ask Mr. Schaefer to come up. The way we're working this now is that those who want to give testimony, you can give testimony on all three of the bills. Realize you have 2 minutes of testimony time. I'm asking you not to read from your testimony. If you have testimony that's written, you can hand it in. If you need to supplement with some verbal testimony, that would be great. If you want to give more information to us than what you can give to us today orally, feel free to give us that information in writing. As I said, the record is going to stay open on all three of these bills at least through the end of next week. So with that, Mr. Schaefer, why don't you go ahead and come up? And I'm going to go ahead and, Mr. Chamberlain, I'm going to have you come back up since you only gave testimony
on the 2891. You need to give your testimony on the other two bills. And let's see, I also have Hillary Mortensen. Mr. Schaefer.
Hello, my name is Joe Schaefer. I work for SEIU Local 503. I'm here. I hadn't planned on testifying today, but there is an organized disinformation campaign against us as we're trying to organize, especially our foster care providers. And so it's not surprising that that's happening, but I was a little bit surprised that that it came up in the context of these bills. Of course, I mean, there are a couple of thousand adult foster care providers in the state, so we have had literally thousands of conversations with folks, going to their doors, speaking to them over the phone, and overwhelmingly it's been very positive. When we speak to folks, they're almost entirely supportive of the effort that we have going on here. And I can't speak to any of the particular circumstances that were brought up today, but I do know that, I mean, this disinformation campaign is being spearheaded by Grover Simmons, and it's part of the plan is to smear our union and make it seem as though we're out there trying to intimidate people into joining a union. But I would submit to you that that would be an insane activity for us to be involved in. Why would we be trying to, like, intimidate people that we wanted to join our association or our union? And if it is happening, we would love to hear about it, and we will root out any examples that there were. But at the same time that this disinformation campaign is actually started, that I know of, in a letter that Mr. Simmons sent out slandering us and also spreading a horrible lie about the cost of union dues, which he greatly exaggerated and then went on to ask for $100 from every recipient of the letter.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I'm sorry to break in here, but I'm going to need to leave for another meeting, and I would like to get an answer to the question that you heard me raise earlier.
Ma'am.
If you can provide an answer, would you do so, please?
Chair Pozanski, Senator Gordley, the way somebody would revoke their card is they would call the Employment Relations Board, and the Employment Relations Board wouldn't count it. Since there is an organized campaign against us, we would have no way of knowing whether or not somebody was actually calling on their own behalf. And because there are so many lies being told about our activities right now, we have no way of verifying over the phone whether or not somebody is actually telling us the truth. So it's the Employment Relations Board's job to do that type of verification work.
So in the case where it was what was provided to us today in testimony, were two lists of names with phone numbers, contact information for people who supposedly want to get their cards back. Is that information you feel comfortable following up on?
Oh, absolutely. I intend to do that, and I'll get you a more substantive answer on exactly how a card is revoked as well. So, and if there's any other questions that you guys would like me to track down answers to, I'm more than happy to do that.
Okay. Thank you.
I do have one other follow-up just on this, since Senator Gordley needs to leave. We heard one witness said that they did a fax or some type of written correspondence trying to get the card back. I'm assuming that if someone does that and you still have that card in your possession, by checking the signature that's on the transmittal letter requesting that, that would be a means of honoring that request as compared to someone on the phone just saying that to somebody?
Yeah, absolutely. And my experience with our union has always been that whenever we receive a correspondence of that type, we deal with it right away. And it's something that we take very seriously, and any allegations that could be proved against us would be horrifying. We are always anxious to take care of that.
All right, thank you. And let's see. Mr. Chamberlain, why don't you go next?
Okay. Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I misspoke at the earlier. Senator Beyer asked me how long cards were good for. Under the Public Employees Collective Bargaining Law, it is 90 days.
Thank you.
Sorry. I'm going to talk about House Bill 2892. To save time, Representative Rosenbaum really talked about the justification for the law, which is a prohibition on the use of state funds to fight organizing. Someone did testify earlier and said that this was a pending court case. It actually has been through the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and they upheld the California law, which is a ban on the the state of ban on the use of state funds by organizing.
I just want to put something on the record. Because we're already past time for this committee, I'm staying as, in a subcommittee capacity. I don't know if Senator Avakian is going to be able to stay. If he's more than willing to stay here, but he may have other commitments. Senator Byron, Senator Gordley, and Senator Monroe, I know those two had to leave. So we're not walking out on you because we don't want to hear you. The thing is, we're trying to accommodate everyone to get all the testimony in. We're in a subcommittee. As I said, we're going to take the testimony. No action is going to happen today, and we'll move on from there.
Senator Brzezinski, to expedite things, I was just concerned about the misstatement about the Court of Appeals case. I'm going to submit my testimony, my written testimony, and let we have some.
Yeah, no, that's fine. I just want to let, we're going to stay here. We've got, I'm good for another 30 minutes at least. And so we'll go ahead and try to get everyone taken care of, but I want to make sure people don't think we're just walking out on you.
And I do have some folks from Bend here.
Yeah, and I'm going to get, that's why we're going to stay. We're going to get everyone in that's on the list right now.
Thank you.
So with that, thank you, Tom.
Hi, thank you, Chair Posansky, and I'm Senator. I know I'm going to say your name wrong.
I'm going to make her try. That's not unfair. You got through Posansky. Avakian. Very
Avakian.
Good.
More importantly, if you'll say your name on the record, then we'll be fine.
My name is Hillary Mortensen, and I'm here to testify on behalf of House Bills 2891, 2892, and 2893. I was an employee of Early Head Start Family Centers of Portland, and in November of 2002, we began an organizing campaign to form a union within Head Start. We did that by having conversations amongst ourselves during our break times, after hours, over phone. We were predominantly a female-based, group of employees. Once we let it be known that we were trying to organize a union and we had a strong majority, we had 60-65% of the workers in our workplace in favor of forming a union. In February of 2002, we submitted our cards to the NLRB. Immediately, the director of the program, Cynthia Wells, started combating us. First, she held a captive audience meeting where she verbally attacked and belittled people, told us that she would quit if a union was brought in. And it was, we were there under the guise of it being an in-service day so we could get training hours to continue being able to teach within the program of Head Start, and instead it turned into an attack on us, the employees. After that, many employees stood up to her, but after that she continued her attacks. She did what I like to call high school tactics. I used to work in the same building with her, and she would come in and she would glare at me and sneer and grunt. And this is a woman who is the same age as my mother. So I found it very interesting that she was acting as unprofessionally as she was. Since those tactics also didn't work, she decided to challenge who was going to be in the bargaining unit. So we went through 12 days of hearings over a three-week period. She hired a woman by the name of Jackie Dam from the Bullard Smith, Jernstein and Wilson firm, who essentially made all of the teachers, the developmental assistants and teachers' assistants, actually it was the developmental assistants and teachers' assistants, feel like they wouldn't even know when to breathe, that they were so incapable of anything, that they wouldn't know the first thing about taking care of children in the classroom and educating them.
Hillary, I'm going to need you to summarize. We've gone over 2 minutes.
Okay. I guess the biggest point I want to make is that through this whole process, she spent well over $50,000, which is public money. And between the money that was spent and the energy that was used by the employees to do what they had a right to do, it's put Early Head Start no longer actually exists anymore. Another corporation called CBI came in and took over because they went into financial hardship, and many employees were lost, and as a result the families of the community lost out more than anything because of our fight.
So I'd just like to thank you for your time.
Thank you for your time and your testimony. All right. I believe our individuals that may be over 100 miles, that I believe from Ben, is it Bill Grosch? Grosch? And Russ Evans? Gentlemen, I just need to find out where you're from.
Oh, from Bend, Central Oregon.
Wonderful.
We've got to get back through tonight. So.
All right. Well, thank you very much for being here today, and we'll take your testimony next.
Thank you.
Shall I go ahead and start?
Sure.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, a member of the committee. My name is Bill Gross, and I drive a dial-a-ride and fixed-route buses for the City of Bend, and my testimony is in favor of 91, 92, and 93. I've handed in the stack over there, so I'll let you read it on your own time. After all, I put in a lot of off-work hours for paratransit services. They're the contractor that I'm working for. It's not the City of Bend that's screwing us over. And basically, we've gone through a unionization process over there, and it's been a real eye-opener. There's been a lot of stress. Two workers have quit. Another one has been fired. He's on my right. And I just kind of find it ironic that in this country that routinely sends ex-presidents to third world countries to oversee their elections, yet right here in the land of the free, companies can use means to derail elections that dictators can only dream of. And just from the heart, I'm a working man. I'm a 60-year-old veteran. I don't wake up in the morning thinking how I can pick a fight with my boss. Instead, through a union, you know, we try to be partners with our employer to add value and not create problems. My wife and I have been married 36 years. We have raised 4 kids to be productive, tax-paying members of society. Our youngest son and his wife are serving in the Peace Corps in West Africa, and there's a connection here. Our two daughters work at Legacy Emmanuel in Portland, and our oldest son and his wife just took in 3 foster kids because they didn't want to see the 3 siblings split up. All along, we've encouraged our kids to play fair in life, and the unionization process at this point is hardly fair for the working man or woman. And now is your chance to level the playing field somewhat. And these bills are small steps in the right direction, and I really appreciate your consideration. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Evans?
Yes, Mr. Chairman members of the committee, wanted to speak on this matter, too, addressing 2891, 92, and 93. I believe all three of these pieces of legislation would help to prevent the kind of tactics that paratransit services has used over in Bend, Oregon to prevent employees from unionizing, from organizing. Employees have approached this matter with the realization or the consciousness that we've got every right to organize, and on the other hand, the company has opposed it bitterly from the beginning, used unethical means to keep us from organizing, and it has affected the morale of workers company-wide, and so we feel strongly that these bills would prevent this kind of abuse on the part of the employer. For example, paratransit services, once they got wind that we were even looking into getting information regarding unionizing, set up a series of mandatory anti-union meetings for all employees, mandatory. And the CEO and also the executive vice president of the company came down from Washington, split all the workers up into groups of 6. This is 40-some workers over a period of 3 days, and basically had a series of what we all call intimidation meetings, where they tried to give us every reason not to unionize and threatened us with loss of our jobs. And at one point, the Bend project manager said loudly in the office, well, we'll just fire them all if they unionize, and we'll replace them. So clearly, things like this were to intimidate people. I have provided, along with my statement, a copy of the memo that I received from the same person, the manager, that there are mandatory meetings scheduled, and these, again, are anti-union meetings, and but it says, you are not invited to this meeting. Well, again, not that I wanted to go to the meeting so much, but things like this are intimidation tactics to make employees feel that they're not part of the family. They're on the outside. And they generated an atmosphere where other employees that were not pro-union gave us the cold shoulder. We were made to feel like outsiders, all because we simply wanted to exercise our right to organize and bargain with the company in good faith. And on our part, it was a last resort. unionization. It was because the company was unwilling to sit down with us at a table and discuss grievances or problems or things and work them out instead of a heavy-handed approach. So we really feel like these bills will help to not necessarily level the playing field, but, for example, mandatory meetings give pro-union informational meetings equal time with the company's mandatory meetings. The company's telling people why they should not unionize, forcing them to be there, paying them to be there so that they can force them to be there, and yet for information from the union, rather than being able to look at both sides, the company really forced that out the door and made it an imbalanced and unfair process. So because of my testimony before the representatives in March, and then also my testimony before the City Council of Bend, asking them to get involved because Paratransit's a contractor with the city, I was fired shortly after this for a very minor infringement, and so I've lost my job, which I loved, my livelihood, a lot of things just because of my support for the union. And employers need to realize that they cannot just put people on a yo-yo like this. They need to respect their rights and show that by their actions.
Thank you for coming over, gentlemen from Bend. Safe travels back. Thank you again.
Thank you very much.
All right, our next panel is going to include John Lee and Bob. Is it Sherry?
Good evening, and thank you for hanging around. My name is John Lee. I'm the former chief executive of the Providence Health System. I retired from there 5 years ago. I'm here today on behalf of Providence to oppose Senate Bill 2893, and the current chief executive, Russ Danielson, has filed a letter for your review. As most of you know, the Sisters of Providence came to the Northwest in 1856, and that began the Providence Health System. Their work is mission-driven, and the mission is to reveal God's love for all, especially the poor and vulnerable, through our compassionate service. Providence seeks to create and sustain a work environment that affirms and fosters respect for human diversity, and we place great importance on the rich diversity within our workplace. We welcome all people who share these values, regardless of their beliefs, to be part of this work. Guided by our mission and core values, Providence seeks to nourish and promote these values along with an understanding of our rich heritage in a variety of ways, including employee orientation and education. We believe that organizational and personal values are essential to build a work environment that supports our employees in their efforts to provide compassionate service to thousands of Oregonians each and every day. In our employee satisfaction surveys, it's also clear that our employees value the values of the Providence Health System. And I've seen those surveys in my 26-year career with Providence. More than simply a right to exercise free speech, Providence views communication with our employees as an indispensable part of who we are and what our employees and patients value. We understand that amendments may be presented for this bill that may mitigate some of our concerns. However, we remain very concerned about the vague and general prohibitions against employer communications combined with the explicit sanctions contained in this measure. As a mission-driven health system, Providence has a long history of advocating for legislation that will help the marginalized and uninsured receive care and services. Our employees know that we frequently advocate for the underserved, and they want to be informed about our actions on legislative matters, and we seek their opinions and value their opinions in this regard. It troubles us to contemplate that a healthcare organization like ours, which advocates so strongly on behalf of the poor and vulnerable, would not be able to communicate with our employees about our advocacy work. In closing, the first rule of medicine is do no harm, and this legislation threatens the core of what healthcare ought to be about, an organization that its employees committed to serving its patients out of deep sense of calling. We would respectfully ask that this bill not advance in the legislative process. Thank you.
Thank you. Bob?
Thank you, Chair Przanski and Senators. This is an opportunity for us to make a statement on this House Bill 2893. I think first I want to say my name's Bob Sherry. I'm the Director of Pastoral and Spiritual Care Services at Sacred Heart Medical Center. I'm part of the Peace Health System. I've worked for about 18 years in that capacity, and prior to that another 6 years in Catholic health care. Peace Health is a mission-based organization, and our mission statement is quite clear. and simple and then shared readily with our employees. We carry on the healing mission of Jesus Christ by promoting personal and community health, relieving pain and suffering, and treating each person in a loving and caring way. While we actively promote that mission, it is not a mission that imposes religion. It says that we promote a healing mission, healing activities, and healing activities are shown by promoting personal health and community health and relieving pain and suffering and treating each person in a loving and caring way. We distinguish ourselves from organizations that impose religion on its employees, that try to get them to join or to become something that they're not. Our organization is about bringing out the best in our employee, helping them to see how valuable it is to bring themselves to work, to bring their own values, to bring their own gifts, to bring their sense of spirituality. You can't be at the bedside of someone dying and not be touched on a very deep level. So the need to draw on those core values, those core sense of identity that we each have, is very important. We believe that House Bill 2893 would have unintended consequences. While it's laudable what it's trying to do, it would perhaps cause trouble in our ability to speak to our own employees about our mission. It would create problems and even raise questions as to whether we can even hang a mission statement on the wall with the words Jesus Christ in it, whether that was an imposition of religious matter. Religious matter is poorly defined in this bill. Could create a lot of trouble for us to be able to even talk to our employees about what we're trying to achieve in terms of healing and compassionate care for our patients, and to talk about its meaning and how they find meaning and purpose in their work. These are issues not of religion, but of spirituality. But because of the wording of this House bill, it would create great complexity for us to even continue our mission and have those kinds of meaningful conversations. The work we do is holistic, body, mind, and spirit. And so the conversations that we have about our work is also holistic. So we ask that House Bill 2893 not be passed, and that if it is passed, the serious amendments would need to be made.
Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there any questions?
May I ask just a couple of questions?
Yes.
I know we're in short time.
That's okay.
Here. You both bring up some very interesting points. Nice seeing you, Mr. Lee. The that we've been in and out of the various definitions that are in this, and I guess what I'm. I guess what I'd like to know, which will help me since we'll be working on this, is the, let's take the hospital, for instance. Forgetting tax laws and this kind of thing, is the hospital, in your mind, considered a bona fide religious organization?
Yes.
Or is it,
yeah, in the case of Providence, definitely.
All right. And, but at the same time, Providence certainly doesn't encourage its employees to join or not join any particular
right.
denomination.
It's not a requirement. Religion is not a requirement for employment.
But it would encourage its employees to support the hospital.
The core values and the mission.
Thanks.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for being here and taking your time out of your day to give us testimony. All right, our next panel is going to be Don Schulenberg, Jeff Stone, and Annie Denecki?
Denecki.
Denecki. I apologize. Please come forward.
Interesting twists and turns with this thing.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
Good afternoon.
Senator Avakian, thank you for your attention. I want to focus today, and I do have testimony I've handed in, on the penalty aspect of the bill. Mm-hmm. The bill, in our opinion, is unfair in that regard, in that it allows court costs and attorney fees for the employee, but it does not allow court costs and attorney fees for the employer. And so we have had the -2 amendments drafted, which would allow court costs for the employer. We think that levels the playing field. It also would deter, shall we say, frivolous claims. And in our situation in agriculture, most of our people are represented pro bono, and there isn't any risk in them losing a case in that regard.
So and I'm assuming the amendment is, I don't see it right in front of me, but it would be for prevailing party?
Actually, the amendment, the court shall award prevailing employer reasonable attorney fees and costs. It also already provides that for the employee, okay, but not for the employer.
Right, gotcha.
Thank you. Having said that, then I would simply also add that so while we support the dash twos, we also can support the dash ones and the dash threes. And I think that add all three of those together, this probably makes it a pretty fair bill. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Jeff?
Mr. Chair, Senator Avakian, I'll be quick. I'm Jeff Stone, Director of Government Relations for the Oregon Association of Nurseries. Giving you our floor letter that we provided on the House side, just as a frame of reference. And on all, the only thing I would like to say on the record is we feel that we have a very good communication style with our employees. It is not unusual for safety meetings that are mandatory. If someone says, come meet Representative X this weekend, that we feel that we should be able to say that at that meeting. It doesn't require them to go, but to actually have that announcement is something that we have a good relationship with them, so we don't feel that infringes upon them. We would agree with a lot of the things that you have heard already, that if folks who punish their employees because they do not follow a particular religious belief or a political belief should not be tolerated. But we feel that this is a pound of solution for something that may not require that type of approach. So with that, I'll conclude my remarks.
Thank you.
Good evening, members of the committee. I'm Ann Denneke. I'm with the firm of Davis Wright Tremaine. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. I have submitted written testimony that fully explains our position relative to the unconstitutionality of House Bill 2893. Now, I too understand that the AFL-CIO has announced a plan to drop the provision in this bill relating to quote-unquote religious matters. Nevertheless, it's very important for the committee to understand that this bill is still unconstitutional because it does broadly regulate speech. Now, you all undoubtedly know that the Oregon Constitution provides some of the strongest protection of free speech in this nation, and I must respectfully disagree with Representative Rosenbaum's comments earlier that this bill is not unconstitutional, and in fact, it is because it does broadly regulate speech without the proper restrictions. It's another point that I don't think I've heard yet is that under the National Labor Relations Act, matters relating to employer-employee communications concerning working conditions is not within the control of this state or any other state. Rather, that is a matter that's preempted by the National Labor Relations Act. And I want to echo Representative Hanna's comments without repeating them, but to say in closing that this bill is very clearly designed to regulate speech and what employers can and cannot talk about. As a result, it's flat out unconstitutional under both the Oregon Constitution and the United States Constitution, and it concerns a matter that is already preempted by federal law. And for that, for those reasons, I urge you to vote against passage of this measure. Thank you.
Questions? Thank you, Senator Avakian.
Thank you, Ms. Seneca. It's very helpful. Obviously, I haven't had a chance to read your memo yet, but the bill applies both to public employers and private employers, and I'm wondering if you're analysis on the free speech, especially with regard to religious matters, is the same for both employers?
Our focus was principally on behalf of private employers as opposed to public employers. So I think you should take it in that regard.
Okay.
Let me follow up on that, too. Based on your statements, it sounds to me that there may be provisions or provisos that would be required to limit how broadly this may be applied or interpreted. I assume, or let me just ask, is there a position that you could give us as to requiring a person who is employed to actually, because they're an employee, to listen to the free speech rights of an employer over the objections of that employee?
Well, I'll be honest with you, that's a long-winded answer, and it probably wouldn't be fair of me to try to answer it right now, given our time constraints. What I'd like to do, if I may, is to email you a more responsive answer.
That'd be wonderful.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you for coming forward, and thank you for being here.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
All right, we have one other panel that's written down here, so I'm going to call them up, and then I'll ask to see if there's anyone else. Courtney, is it Niebel? And Charlie Finger and Ricardo Rodriguez. Is there anyone else besides these three who wanted to testify that did not get on one of the three lists? All right, this will be our last panel. All right, whatever order you want to go in. So why don't we just start at this end?
Okay. For the record, my name is Ricardo Rodriguez. Dear Mr. Chairman and member of the committee, I work for a nursing home, Maryville Nursing Home in Beaverton. And it's funny how these people with suits and nice shoes come here and talk about democracy when we don't have that democracy in our workplace. I support and my co-workers support Bill 2893 because we try to organize a union at Maryville that is mission-based, service with love. And the service with love only ends as soon as you step into your workplace. We as employees living in this country of the free, lost our basic rights as soon as you step into your workplace. There is no right to organize, and we are forced to attend mandatory meetings. And in these meetings, of course, they just trash the union. And I guess part of the American dream has been fulfilled by having organized labor in our workplace, something that is not happening anymore. As you know, so at Providence, they are trying to organize 3,000 employees, and they're having the same problems, the same issues. Basically, what I would like to see is this bill to pass. Because it will not only regulate the speech, it will level the field for employers and for employees to get the right information. I know the employers have all the right to talk about anti-union, their anti-union messages, but we don't have the same rights. We have to put up with their, you know, consultants that they pay thousands of dollars. They rather pay people from out of the state thousands of dollars than to give us the basic right to organize. And it's not about money, it's about bringing the quality of care to the level that it's supposed to be, because hopefully not, but in the future either one of us who are sitting in this room will end in a hospital bed or in a nursing home. And the way the quality of care is diminishing because there is no organized labor. We cannot demand better care for our residents. We have to listen to the same song that the employers want to say, and it's, we care, and we care for our residents, but we don't care about you guys. Thank you.
Thank you. Courtney?
Yeah, my name is Courtney Niebel, and I'm an organizer with the Oregon Nurses Association, and I'm speaking here today on behalf of the nurses at Mercy Medical Center in Roseburg. They recently went through an organizing drive that I helped them to attain a union at their hospital. And I want to just say that the main reason that they wanted to organize was to improve patient care, and struggled with their managers and supervisors being too concerned with budget and not as concerned with patient care. I did submit written testimony that is more detailed, and also a letter from a nurse down there. Unfortunately, none of them could make it up here today to testify. I wanted to tell you about two different things that happened during our organizing campaign down there. The first thing that occurred was that after collecting well over 70% of union authorization cards from nurses, it became evident in a pre-hearing, which always occurs before an election. They set an election date. They stipulate who is eligible to vote and who is not. And in that pre-hearing meeting, it became evident that the hospital was going to challenge the election based on the fact that there had been some charge nurses on the organizing committee collecting cards. Through extensive conversations with those charge nurses, they did not feel that they were in a supervisory role. None of the nurses that worked in their departments felt that they were in a supervisory role, but nevertheless, the hospital was planning to challenge the election based on the fact that it was tainted by supervisory influence. So I just want to point out that in that instance, even though the workers did everything right, the union did everything right, the hospital would still have had the ability to challenge it, which would have held up the election results in the court system for who knows how long. Well, the workers would have lost their momentum and possibly their interest. The second thing that the hospital did is they held mandatory meetings, which pulled nurses off of the floor, and rather than providing staff to cover those nurses' patients, they doubled the patient load for other nurses remaining on the floor. So they made these nurses come down and sit in an hour-long meeting once a week, and in the meantime, nurses up on the floor were left with twice the amount of patients that they would normally have. There were threats of being terminated if you didn't show up for these meetings. They also did some very blatant intimidation tactics during these meetings, where if a pro-union worker chose to speak and clarify something that the hospital was saying, they would very shortly be flanked on either side by a supervisor. They also showed an intimidating video about the rampant nature of strikes that could turn into riots, and failed to mention the very small percentage of contract campaigns that ever turn into a strike. Didn't give both sides of the story,
Courtney,
whatsoever.
I need you to summarize if you're not
That's
there.
It. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. Charlie?
Yes.
Need to get a microphone in front of you, please.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I figured I had a loud enough mouth. Good afternoon, Senators. My name is Charlie Finger. I'm a proud member of the Inland Boatmen's Union of the Pacific. I live in Portland, Oregon. Come from a heavy industrial, very hazardous environment is where we work. And on top of that, we were faced with a abusive and autocratic manager, arbitrary rules, and contemptuous disregard for our safety. Individual attempts to try and remedy this situation not only fell on deaf ears, but made the situation worse. So we collectively decided to become a union. We signed union pledge cards, and 100% of us, and delivered it to the president and CEO, and speaking for the company, informed us that we don't believe you mean this. Can you get any more disrespectful than that? They then proceeded, of course, on the standard union avoidance program that, to my ears, the testimony that I heard earlier from the private health care workers sounded really familiar. That's pretty much what it sounded like. Free speech, we had to sit there and shut up. There was no discourse, questions, nothing. Stuff was mailed to our homes. And this is a company that remained itself very aloof. They didn't really have much contact with us, the upper echelons of it, until this transpired. Then we had one-on-one meetings, and that's how it went. Eventually, yes, we were successful in organizing and went through a labor relations board vote. And it was quite a process. And if I can do anything to try and influence any of it so that other people coming behind us may not have to do this, so that if they need to organize, that they could do so without this type of treatment on top of everything else. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, all three of you, for coming down and waiting for us to get to your testimony. With that, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearings on 2891, 2892, and 2893. And Ms. Vaughn, anything else we need to cover?
No, Mr. Chair.
The subcommittee for State Senate Commerce is now closed, and we're adjourned. Thank you.